Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. The rush of racing? Nothing beats it. But Chumba Casino comes close. Chumba's got fast spins, fun games, daily bonuses, and all the action you can handle. Now that's a ride. Ready to hit the throttle? Get in the driver's seat and head to ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Fire Eyes Media.
What Melissa Left, a limited series by Weird True Crime. On Thursday, June 26th, 2025, in Taos, New Mexico, Melissa Casillas drops a sandwich off to her daughter on her lunch break, and sometime in the next hour and a half, she vanishes.
Her purse, wallet, and keys are at home. Both of her personal phones are at home, and they've been wiped completely clean. Her Volkswagen Jetta is still sitting in the driveway. The only thing missing is Melissa.
She had PTO scheduled to help her mom recover from knee surgery starting that Monday. She had a lake trip planned for the weekend and hunting trips booked. She had just been offered a new job and didn't know it yet because she wasn't around to answer the call. A woman who is planning to disappear doesn't plan for the future.
There has been a lot of coverage on Melissa's disappearance. Unfortunately, some of the information shared is incorrect or has been sensationalized to drive more engagement. She's been tied to missing scientists and some sort of government CIA conspiracy.
But the truth is, 53-year-old Melissa Casillas was a mother in an unhealthy marriage, trying to give her daughter a better life. She got up on June 26, 2025, got in a fight with her husband, didn't show up to work, and then vanished. We are working closely with Melissa's family on this case, and I'm not kidding when I say we get new information daily. The latest developments are huge, and we will be sharing what we can with you in these episodes. So let's get into it. I'm Gina.
And I'm Amber.
And this is part one, June 26th.
Melissa Shirley Mondragon was born on November 1, 1971, in Taos, New Mexico. She grew up in Taos with her sister Trudy and her brother Joseph. And if you ask the people who loved her to describe her, the first thing they'll tell you about is her books.
Melissa was a reader, like a serious reader. She always had a book with her. Trudy shared that if Melissa found an author she loved, she would collect every single one of their books. She and Trudy were constantly asking each other what they were reading and swapping author recommendations. Melissa would even put her initials on the inside cover of them and sometimes the date she got them. She was sentimental like that.
She had recently started listening to audiobooks because life had gotten so busy. She told Trudy she loved it when she drove to work alone because she could listen to her book the whole way there.
Oh, the way I deeply relate to Melissa's love for some peace and quiet. And an audiobook. And we can both relate to Melissa and Trudy's bookworm tendencies.
Oh, yes, we can. My bookshelf is one of my most prized possessions, and I can't begin to tell you the lengths I've gone to make sure I have every book from my favorite authors. Gina and I are constantly sharing book recommendations, too. It's very clear that books are part of Melissa's love language as well.
Jasmine, that's Trudy's daughter and Melissa's niece, showed off a beautiful hardcover copy of Black Beauty that Melissa gave her when she was little. Melissa signed it and wrote notes inside. Jasmine made sure to point out how gorgeous Melissa's handwriting is, and she's right about that. She has the prettiest handwriting. Melissa also loves plants. I'm pretty sure we would have been fast friends. Trudy told me about a time when Melissa showed up with two or three boxes of plant clippings and how excited she was because she didn't have those plants yet. Melissa was always looking up how to take care of different plants and talking about them. And she grew poppies, but not the typical orange or red ones you'd see around house. Melissa grew pink and peach poppies. She told Trudy where she ordered the bulbs and exactly how to care for them.
She loves the outdoors and the mountains. She has three dogs and two cats, and she loves horses. She's also an avid big game hunter, and we don't mean casually. She really knows her stuff. She even owns a handgun and carries it in the mountains.
At the time of her disappearance, Melissa worked as an administrative assistant at Los Alamos National Laboratory, LANL, one of the most significant research institutions in the country. She had security clearance. About 3 weeks before she went missing, she lost that clearance and was moved to a non-security site at the lab.
Melissa married Mark Casillas on June 25, 2005. Their one daughter, Sierra, was born the following year. And Melissa was deeply, fiercely devoted to Sierra. After Sierra was involved in a traumatic accident, Melissa took care of her around the clock. She would go to the store in the middle of the night for whatever Sierra needed. She went up to Sierra's high school and talked to the administration to make sure she was looked after. They had the Life 360 app to track each other's locations at all times. And because Melissa couldn't bring her personal phone to work, she would text or call Sierra at every break and lunch to check in.
Melissa was also a thyroid cancer survivor. She had her thyroid removed and had to take daily medication to supplement the hormone her body could no longer produce on its own. That medication is not optional. Without it, her body cannot function normally, and she would be in serious trouble in a matter of weeks.
Now, and this is important, Melissa was planning to leave Mark. She told a friend she was looking at apartments at Albuquerque so she and Sierra could live together while Sierra attended school. Trudy had been sending her apartment listings in safe parts of town, and Melissa was thinking about what her budget would look like.
Interestingly, she had a storage unit, Unit 35, Building E, at a storage unit that Mark and her parents didn't even know existed. The contract was in her father Jose's name.
Also, just to put this out there, the storage unit was discovered after she went missing and was still full of random items.
She had also applied for a new job with a contractor that works with LANL. The company was based in Seattle, but Melissa would have been working at Los Alamos or remotely, which would have allowed her to live in Albuquerque with Sierra. This also fits in with the idea that she was looking for an employment opportunity that allowed her to get away from Mark. They tried to call her after she disappeared to tell her she got the job.
She had paid time off scheduled starting June 30th to help her mom recover from knee surgery. She had a lake trip planned for June 29th and 30th, an archery retreat the following weekend, a trip to Sturgis, South Dakota for a motorcycle rally in August, and two hunting trips booked, one in Unit 23 in Lower Gila and one in Unit 18 near Socorro.
That is not the behavior of someone trying to disappear. That is someone who wanted to stay connected.
Jasmine told us that, even though she and Melissa weren't as close once she was an adult, work, distance, and life got in the way, she did spend time with Melissa when she was young. She shared this cute story about going with Melissa to work, and she let Jasmine pick out the clip art she liked and printed it out for her. She always had a positive relationship with her, and they spent time together when possible.
One of those times was at Sierra's graduation party on June 21st, just 5 days before she went missing. They were talking, and Melissa made a Seinfeld reference, and Jasmine lit up because she loves that kind of humor. They had texted each other just a couple of days before Melissa disappeared. Trudy also shared something that really got to me. Melissa had expressed feelings of guilt. She said she felt like a bad daughter because she couldn't check in on her parents as much as she wanted.
Trudy would remind her that she was a mother, a wife. She worked full-time, and she was doing everything she could. But that guilt tells you something about who Melissa is. She cared so much that she felt bad for not doing more.
And Melissa's deep concern for her parents leads us to another important point, one that has been manipulated and sensationalized for the media. Melissa was never cut off from her family. There was never a falling out. This narrative was so upsetting to Melissa's mom that she literally pulled out her old phones to look at family pictures.
Trudy shared that Melissa's parents were there when Sierra was a newborn. They would keep Sierra for the weekend when Melissa and Mark went on hunting trips and take her to school or drop her off. She shared this adorable story about how Sierra was fiercely independent and didn't want to sleep in her grandparents' room, but she didn't want to sleep alone either. So Joanne, Melissa's mom, would make a cushiony pallet on the floor on her side of the bed, so if Sierra got scared, she could be right next to Grandma.
Melissa's parents also went to Sierra's graduation at the beginning of June. Trudy shared that Joanne was in a lot of pain due to her knee, the one that she was scheduled to have surgery on, and Melissa helped her walk across the uneven ground and took care of her, making sure she had a place to sit and didn't have to stand too long. They also attended Sierra's graduation party on June 21st.
Trudy and Melissa had been making plans for how to split responsibilities after Joanne's knee replacement on June 30th. Who would stay when and for how long? Who would get the groceries, any necessary medications? I mean, you get the idea. So why are we going on for so long about Melissa's interests and her relationship with her family?
Because Melissa's love for life, her nurturing personality, her feelings of guilt for not doing more for her parents, and the deep connection she had with Sierra are prime examples of why she would not choose to leave on her own. Someone who cares as deeply for the people and other living things around her isn't going to just disappear.
Everything we're sharing comes from official police reports or directly from Melissa's family and people close to her. We are omitting some names to protect sources, but these are real people, and some have stated they are willing to testify. We are not speculating. We have documentation, and some of the things we're going to share completely contradict what we thought we knew about this case.
There are aspects of Mark and Melissa's relationship that we'll be addressing throughout these episodes, aspects that paint a clearer picture of what multiple sources describe as an imbalance of power and controlling behavior. We don't use words like abuse lightly, but it is a documented and relevant part of Melissa's story, and we would be doing her a disservice by leaving it out.
We also want to be transparent about something. We are aware that talking about the dynamics of this relationship, before we even know what happened to Melissa, can sound like we're building a case against her husband.
We're not here to do that. We have no definitive proof of what happened to Melissa.
What we do have are documented accounts from multiple people, sourced from police reports and direct conversations that help explain who Melissa was, what her life looked like, and why the people who love her are asking the questions they're asking.
Before we get into June 26th, we need to establish something important. Of everything that happened that day, very little can be independently verified. What we know for certain is this. Melissa brought Sierra lunch at the John Dunn Shops at 12:57 p.m., and her phone was reset at 1:38 p.m. Beyond that, the accounts of what happened that morning, the evidence that was found, and what we've been told about her movements that day come primarily from Mark. And as you'll hear throughout this episode, those accounts change depending on who he's talking to.
Melissa and Mark carpooled to Los Alamos every day because they both worked there. Mark told Melissa's sister Trudy and Trudy's daughter Jasmine that he and Melissa had been fighting all morning. He said he caught her hiding a vape pen in a dresser drawer. He said he wasn't upset she was vaping, he was upset she was hiding it from him. According to Mark, the argument continued on the way to work.
Mark told Trudy and Jasmine that once they arrived, Melissa realized she had forgotten her badge. Without it, she couldn't get into her building. So he says she decided to work from home and told him he needed to find his, quote, own effing way home, end quote.
Here's a detail from the police report worth noting. A LANL investigator, Andrew Goldie, confirmed that Mark's position as superintendent doesn't require him to badge in as frequently as Melissa's role does. Melissa had scanned her badge regularly between June 23rd and 25th. Mark hadn't scanned his since June 23rd. So the badge story matters more for her than it would for him. It also raises some questions we'll get into soon.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Now, and this is where things start to fracture, the police report contains conflicting information. Multiple pages state that the LANL security team could not verify how he arrived to work on June 26th. License plate readers that had captured Melissa's Volkswagen Jetta every single weekday within a 20-minute window going all the way back to January did not detect her car driving through Espanola or Los Alamos on June 26th. Not once.
However, one page in the same report states that Melissa's car was seen on surveillance at LANL Guard Shack at 6:13 a.m., with Melissa in the driver's seat and Mark suspected, but not verified, to be in the passenger seat. At 6:20 a.m., the Jetta is seen leaving the property. So there are contradictions even within official record. What we know is she did not drive through the main corridors that would have been captured by the plate readers she had been on consistently for months. And that Mark was suspected to be in the car, but him getting to work that day couldn't be verified.
Mark also told investigators that he and Melissa stopped at the Avenue gas station in Santa Clara that morning to pick up a few things and use the bathroom. Surveillance footage showed Melissa's car was never at the gas station that day. When that was pointed out, Mark changed his story and said they didn't stop at the gas station after all.
According to the police records, Melissa sent an email to a coworker at LANL that morning. It reads, quote, "Morning, something came up with Sierra. I will be a little late this morning," end quote. Some people have flagged this as Melissa telling different stories about her plans because she was leaving and trying to throw people off. But the more reasonable explanation? She was in a fight with her husband, decided to go back home, and didn't want to share her personal business with a coworker. I'm sure a lot of us can relate to this.
Absolutely. I've done this on a bad morning when I've gotten into a fight with my husband or one of my kids and didn't want to be at work.
I mean, it's not unheard of. She also had an understanding with LANL about needing to take sudden time off to help Sierra, who, as we said, was going through some personal difficulties at the time. So saying she needed to help Sierra was an easy explanation.
The police report also documents two bank transactions from Melissa's Step Inc. account before 7:06 a.m. that morning, a declined payment of $367.66 to Root Insurance, and another declined payment of $45.03 to Amazon. Why would she be worried about paying bills if she planned to walk away from her life that afternoon?
At 12:57 p.m., Melissa shows up on surveillance footage at the John Dunn Shops in Taos. She's bringing Sierra lunch at the cafe where she works. In the footage, Melissa pulls into a handicapped parking spot in a somewhat erratic way. She comes in fast, hits the bumper, and partially rolls over it before stopping. Sierra said Melissa seemed fine. She gave Melissa a paycheck to deposit at the bank, and that was the last time Sierra saw her mother.
According to the police reports, Sierra received the last text from Melissa at 1:33 p.m. Then, around 2:30 p.m., she noticed that the text she was sending to her mom had switched from blue to green. If you have an iPhone, you know exactly what that means. iMessage stopped working. The phone is off, disconnected from cell service, or the SIM has been removed.
All right, this part gets me. Around 4:30 p.m., Sierra called Melissa's mother, Joanne, while she was at the store with Trudy in Albuquerque. Trudy told us Sierra was hysterical, screaming and crying so loudly that Trudy could hear her through the phone. She was unintelligible. The only thing Joanne could make out was that something was wrong with Melissa. This made Joanne start crying and shut down, so Trudy took the phone. Trudy put on what she called her 911 voice, calm and focused, and asked Sierra direct questions. Sierra said she got home from work and everything was there, but Melissa wasn't. Trudy gave Sierra a list of people to call who might know where Melissa was and then called their brother Joseph.
Joseph, who you'll hear us refer to as Jody, lives only a couple of minutes from Mark and Melissa and arrived at the house before Mark did. When Mark got there, they searched the property together. According to Trudy, Jody saw what appeared to be evidence of a struggle in the yard. Mark dismissed it. What Mark was focused on were unfamiliar tire tracks. He was convinced they proved that someone, a potential boyfriend, had come and picked Melissa up. Jody said he was getting increasingly frustrated with Mark because he was taking so long to call the police. Trudy shared that Captain Martinez from the New Mexico State Police informed her that Mark called his son-in-law, a Rio Rancho police officer, before he called the non-emergency line. And even then, why the non-emergency line? Why not 911?
So Mark called non-emergency and reported Melissa missing at 4:59 p.m. Dispatch informed Officer Joshua Leyba at 5:02 p.m. Leyba tried to call Mark at 5:16. Mark didn't answer. According to the police report, he tried calling Mark multiple times over the next several minutes. Mark finally called back at 5:33 p.m. Your wife is missing, and you're not answering the phone when the police call you back? What is happening to prevent you from answering that call? Wouldn't answering that call be your number one priority at that moment?
You would think. By the time Trudy and Jasmine arrived at the house, after 8 p.m., Sierra had completely shifted. Remember, she had been hysterical, sobbing, and unintelligible a few hours earlier. Now she was calm, acting like everything was fine. And Trudy noted that Mark was hovering over Sierra the entire evening and that Sierra never had a conversation with the police on her own.
On the way to Taos, Trudy and Jasmine started making calls to Melissa's friends, police stations, and hospitals. As true crime aficionados, they know the first 48 hours of a missing person case are the most crucial and the most hectic, so they made a flyer to post on social media. But because Mark and Sierra were being questioned by the police, Jasmine temporarily put her phone number on the flyer and posted it online around 9:30 p.m. Within 15 minutes, Jasmine got a phone call.
Lloyd Duran had an important tip. He thought he spotted Melissa walking along Highway 518 eastbound in Talpa around 2:18 p.m.
He actually thinks he saw her twice. He drove past her, pulled over to eat, then drove further east on 518 to try to get a better look and confirm it was her. He did confirm it was her, so he turned around to go back and talk to her. The whole thing took about 3 minutes, but when he got back to where she should have been, she was gone.
What he did see was a newer model, around a 2020, dark blue Dodge Ram long bed with tinted windows, gaining speed heading east on 518. It looked like the truck had stopped and then taken off. The woman he saw was nowhere on the road. There were no other vehicles around. Lloyd described who he assumed to be Melissa as walking fast with her head down, wearing blue jeans, tennis shoes, and what appeared to be a white shirt or sweater.
Jasmine and Trudy immediately went to tell the two officers on scene about the tip. Mark interrupted. He said it couldn't be Melissa because she, quote, didn't have a white sweater, end quote. And because Mark said that in front of New Mexico State Police, the officers didn't follow up on Lloyd's tip. They took Mark's word for it and moved on.
Trudy and Jasmine found this strange for a couple of reasons. First, why would you immediately shut down a tip without any investigation at all? And why would NMSP just take his word for it and not investigate it further?
Mark was also irritated that they had posted the flyer online at all. He said something to the effect of, "Why did you guys do this? Your wife is missing and you're annoyed that her family is trying to find her."
The first thing Mark said to Trudy and Jasmine that night was that Melissa, quote, was an idiot and had been on a roll with F-ups at work and was about to be fired. He said they were both on the verge of losing their clearances because of her and called her, quote, so dumb for forgetting her badge.
He also said Melissa single-handedly ruined their finances, so he had no idea they were in debt. He'd only recently discovered she wrecked their credit by only paying minimums. Mark also told Trudy and Jasmine that Melissa was under a lot of stress and pressure, but kept everything inside. The family shared that they feel like this was an attempt to control the narrative.
In our interview, Jasmine said that if Mark had been more of a leader in the search for Melissa in the beginning, she and the rest of the family would have followed along. When she, Trudy, and the other family members got to Taos on June 26th, the intention was to help Mark however they could. As stated earlier, the only reason Jasmine's number was on the missing person flyer was because Mark and Sierra were busy with the police and isolated from them. The plan was to change the number to Mark's once he was more available.
But then the first thing Mark did was make negative statements about Melissa, told them about a fight that morning, said she was an idiot and so stupid, and dismissed a crucial tip from Loy Duran. These actions immediately raised red flags and made them feel uncomfortable. Those are not the actions of a man who is concerned about his wife's well-being.
According to Trudy, Joanne asked Mark if all the guns and handguns in the house were accounted for. Mark said they were all there, and Melissa didn't know how to use a handgun. This is not true. Melissa is a hunter. She owned a handgun that she carried with her any time she went into the mountains. Her gun was not in the house. It has yet to be located.
When Officer Anthony Bencomo arrived at the house, Mark walked him through the property. And almost immediately, Mark started saying things that raised more red flags. According to the police report, he told the officer that he noticed a black bag and a blue bag containing hunting clothing was missing. We'll get back to this. Also, one of the first things he volunteered was the following, quote, "If there was a struggle at any point, there would have been several items in the house that would have been knocked over," end quote. He pointed this out himself. He also made a point of repeatedly mentioning that he was a professional outfitter with expertise in tracking.
I'm sorry, but telling investigators, completely unprompted, that there definitely wasn't a struggle in the house is suspicious. And I'm going to say this in the nicest way possible. The house was cluttered. So if there had been a struggle, it would have been easy for it to go unnoticed.
The report also states that several rifles and bows were found in the master bedroom, along with a revolver on Mark's nightstand. Hunting packs were hanging on the wall in the laundry room, and it didn't appear that any of them were missing. No further investigation was done on the weapons in the home or verification to determine whether all guns were present and accounted for. Again, Melissa's handgun has never been found.
When Bencomo inspected several pairs of boots in the house located near a fish tank in the master bedroom, Mark said he hadn't worn them in close to a month. In fact, he hadn't worn them in so long there were spider webs inside them. But one pair in particular, a pair of Danner 400 series camo boots, size 9, had fresh mud on the tread near the toe area. The right boot had dried mud on the sole, and the mud from the toe down to the arch was wet. Mark said that was strange. When he looked at the inside of the boots, Bencomo noted there were no spider webs.
There are a couple of things I want to point out about the boots. One, there is conflicting information from Mark in the report. Officer Bencomo reported that Mark said he hadn't worn them in close to a month, but another report written by Officer Richard Candelaria states Mark told agents he hadn't worn the boots in years. In the same report, it's noted that the fish tank was located directly above the boots, raising the possibility that leaking water may have caused moisture on the boot.
But there's no note about any of the other shoes being wet, an active leak, or water on the floor under the tank. We've both had fish tanks. If there had been a leak, wouldn't there be more evidence to point to that? Not just wetness on one area of one boot. It's a weird statement to make.
I mean, I get the whole saying, when you hear hoofbeats, think horse, not zebra. But zebras exist. According to the police report, Bencomo found a red stain on the floor near the fish tank and boots. It was consistent in appearance with blood. A hemostick presumptive test was conducted on site. It came back positive for blood. Samples were collected and sent for testing. The family is still waiting on the results.
Let's pause for a minute and talk about what Melissa allegedly took with her.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest here, and if you're looking for some serious fun, head over to ChumbaCasino.com. At ChumbaCasino, you can play all your favorite social casino-style games for free anytime, anywhere. It's the most fun you can have on your phone or computer.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21+.
When Bencomo asked Mark about Melissa's belongings, he said everything was in the house. Her purse, debit and credit cards, both personal phones, her work phone, her wallet, her vehicle, and her car keys. Days later, on July 2nd, when surveillance footage was found, Mark informed the family that Melissa took a black backpack with her medication, a toothbrush, and her curling iron. We'll dive into this more in part two, but let's take a look at this from a high level.
Okay, so she took a curling iron, but not her car keys. She took a toothbrush, but left her wallet, every card she owns, and according to Mark, thousands and thousands of dollars in the safe. And she left behind a cross necklace she had inherited from her mother-in-law, one she never took off, sitting on a table in the house. Trudy told us that Sierra herself said Melissa didn't care much about makeup, but her hair always had to be done. So the curling iron detail has been used to suggest she packed intentionally. Who intentionally packs a curling iron and a toothbrush but leaves behind every article of clothing they own, money, and an ID?
That same evening, Bencomo questioned Sierra at the house. According to the police report, Sierra said she saw Melissa that morning around 7:30 a.m., which was unusual. Melissa told her she'd forgotten her badge and was going to work from home. Sierra then said Melissa brought her lunch around 1:30 p.m. and didn't seem distressed. Side note for clarification here, Sierra said it was around 1:30 p.m., but the surveillance footage from the John Dunn shops says 12:57 p.m.
Sierra said she received the last text from Melissa at approximately 1:33 p.m. and that Mark called her at 2:30 p.m., concerned about Melissa and asking if she could track her. Sierra also told police that when she got home, she found both of Melissa's personal phones, her old phone and her new phone, displaying a welcome screen. They had been factory reset. Every photo, every text, every contact gone. Her work phone was also at home and had not been reset. But maybe not for lack of trying. It couldn't be reset because it has a software lock on it, an app called Jamf, a remote management tool used by companies. In order to unlock it, you need a 6-digit code provided by an administrator.
Trudy told us that as sentimental as Melissa was, it's almost unimaginable that she would voluntarily erase all of her pictures of Sierra. Even the police report notes that Mark mentioned it was strange given how many photos she had of her daughter.
Mark was formally interviewed at the New Mexico State Police office at 9:55 p.m. that night. He told Officer Villanueva that Melissa dropped him off at approximately 6:15 a.m. Mark was formally interviewed at the New Mexico State Police office at 9:55 p.m. that night. He told Officer Villanueva that Melissa dropped him off at approximately 6:15 a.m. He told her he needed the car by 11 a.m. for an appointment at the bank, and that when he called her around 10:45 a.m., she didn't answer. He said he continued to call and text her, but she never responded, and that it was out of character for her not to text or call back.
But Mark had already told Trudy and Jasmine that Melissa forgot her badge and told him to find his own effing way home because they were fighting. According to the police report, he left that detail out. Melissa was just being uncharacteristically unresponsive. If they were in a fight, it would make perfect sense for her not to answer. Who hasn't gotten into a fight with a significant other and ignored their text and calls for a while? Different stories for different audiences.
In that same police interview, Mark said he spoke with Sierra later in the day and asked if she had talked to Melissa. Sierra confirmed that she saw her at 7:30 a.m. that morning and that Melissa said she left her badge at home, so she was going to work from home or take the day off to run errands. Mark told the officer this wasn't true because Melissa gave her badge to the Lanel security guard when they got to work that morning. According to Mark, Melissa told Sierra he needed to find a ride home. Again, this is not what he told Melissa's family. Not to mention that Lanel investigators confirmed that Melissa did not badge in that morning.
Are y'all as turned around as we are? Just hold on, because it gets even more confusing. In this interview, Mark says he got a call from Melissa's boss around 2 p.m., asking where Melissa was because she didn't come in to work. He goes on to say that Sierra called him around 3 p.m. to say she had come home, the door was locked, Melissa's things were there, and Melissa wasn't.
But Sierra told the police that Mark called her at 2:30 asking her to track Melissa's location. So which is it? Did Mark call Sierra at 2:30 worried about Melissa? Or did Sierra call Mark at 3 p.m. to tell him Melissa wasn't home? These are two completely different narratives, and they cannot both be true. And believe it or not, that series of events gets even more confusing. So put a pin in that for a minute.
Mark told Officer Villanueva that he got a ride home from a coworker named Heriberto Martinez, leaving Lanel around 3:30 p.m. and arriving home around 4:45 p.m. Beto was later interviewed and confirmed the ride, adding that they stopped at a gas station along the way. Why you would stop at a gas station for drinks when you know your wife is missing is beyond me, but okay. According to Beto, Mark tried to call Melissa during the drive back, but there was no answer. He also called Sierra to see if she had spoken to Melissa that day.
This is when we come back to that timeline. Sierra said Mark called her at 2:30 asking if she had talked to Melissa. But Beto is saying this call took place on their drive back to Taos, which would have been after 3:30. And then you have Mark saying that Sierra called him at 3, worried because Melissa's stuff was home, but she wasn't. Ouch, my brain.
It's also important to note the times that Melissa's phones were reset. One of the phones was reset at 8:02 a.m. The second phone, the newer one, was reset at 1:38 p.m., 5 minutes after she texted Sierra. So if Mark is trying to call Melissa on his way home after 3:30, those calls aren't going through. It wouldn't even ring. But he's saying she's not answering. It's Mark's word over everyone else's, and his word continually changes.
A coworker named Adam Drake was also interviewed. He confirmed Mark was at work and that they attended a meeting together from 1:30 to 2 p.m. Mark seemed fine and didn't mention anything personal. The Lanel investigator stated he could not verify how Mark arrived at work that morning. Mark's badge hadn't been scanned since June 23rd. The license plate readers that had captured Melissa's car on every other weekday going back to January didn't pick it up at all that day. Beto's account of the ride home wasn't independently verified. The GPS on his vehicle was never checked, and the gas station stop he mentioned wasn't confirmed by investigators.
We are not in the business of making accusations that we can't back up, but we will say this. There is a meaningful lack of verifiable evidence placing Mark where he says he was on June 26th. There are also witness statements, some of which we can't share publicly because they're part of an active investigation, that have led both the family and investigators to ask serious questions about his whereabouts that day. Those questions haven't been answered.
We've only covered the day Melissa disappeared. There's so much more to discuss about the days and weeks that followed, the investigation, strange phone calls and witnesses, and the growing list of things about Mark Casillas' behavior that her family cannot explain away.
And we'll get into all of it in part two, which you don't have to wait for because it's available right now. We'll see you there. Until next time, stay safe.
And make good choices.
Bye.
Bye.
What's up, Boos? Main Event Jey Uso here from the WWE. When it's just me between matches, it's day one-ish. And that means it's Chumba time. With hundreds of casino-style games and new titles arriving weekly, there's always something fresh to try at Chumba Casino. The daily boosts make it even more fun. And have me about to get them all during my downtime. Ready for a fun way to chill out and enjoy a few minutes for yourself? Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See T's and C's. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.